You could say that the modern movement toward black freedom and equality really began immediately after World War II. For long years, the slow fire of discontent, Martin's phrase, had burned almost unnoticed under the crust of apparent peace imposed by predominantly white society, not just in America, but all over the world. In America, one of the first steps toward racial justice was taken on December the 5th, 1946, when President Harry S. Truman appointed a group of distinguished citizens as members of the President's Committee on Civil Rights. The next big breakthrough in the United States came on May 17, 1954. Martin was working on his doctoral thesis in Boston when the Supreme Court reversed its ancient opinion that separate but equal educational facilities met the requirements of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. In 1955, the court followed this decision with another ordering public educational facilities in the United States to be desegregated with all deliberate speed, an unfortunate phrase that slowed the process up. From the time he came to Montgomery, Martin followed his commitment to work against all forms of segregation. Of all the facets of segregation in Montgomery, the most degrading were the rules of the Montgomery City bus lines. This northern-owned corporation outdid the South itself. Although 70% of its passengers were black, it treated them like cattle. Worse than that, for nobody insults a cow. The first seats on all buses were reserved for whites. Even if they were unoccupied and the rear seats crowded, Negroes would have to stand at the back in case some whites might get aboard. And if the front seats happened to be occupied and more white people boarded the bus, black people seated in the rear were forced to get up and give them their seats. Furthermore, and I don't think Northerners ever realized this, Negroes had to pay their fares at the front of the bus, get off, and walk to the rear door to board again. Sometimes the bus would drive off without them after they had paid their fare. This would happen to elderly people or pregnant women in bad weather or good, and was considered a great joke by the drivers. Frequently, the white bus drivers abused their passengers, calling them niggers, black cows, or black apes. Imagine what it was like, for example, for a black man to get on a bus with his son and be subjected to such treatment. The fuel that finally made that slow-burning fire blaze up was an almost routine incident. On December 1st, 1955, Mrs. Rosa Parks, a 42-year-old seamstress whom my husband aptly described as a charming person with a radiant personality, boarded a bus to go home after a long day working and shopping. The bus was crowded, and Mrs. Parks found a seat at the beginning of the Negro section. At the next stop, more whites got on. The driver ordered Mrs. Parks to give up her seat to a white man who boarded. This meant that she would have to stand all the way home. Mrs. Parks was not in a revolutionary frame of mind. She had not planned to do what she did. Her cup had run over. As she said later, "I was just plain tired and my feet hurt." So she sat there, refusing to get up. The driver called a policeman who arrested her and took her to the courthouse. From there, Mrs. Parks called E.D. Nixon, who came down and signed a bail bond for her. Mr. Nixon was a fiery Alabamian. He was a Pullman porter who had been active in A. Philip Randolph's Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and in civil rights activities. Suddenly, he also had enough. Suddenly, it seemed, almost every Negro in Montgomery had had enough. It was spontaneous combustion. Phones began ringing all over the Negro section of the city. The Women's Political Council suggested a one-day boycott of the buses as a protest. E.D. Nixon courageously agreed to organize it. The first we knew about it was when Mr. Nixon called my husband early in the morning of Friday, December 2nd. He had already talked to Ralph Abernathy. After describing the incident, Mr. Nixon said, "We have taken this type of thing too long. I feel the time has come to boycott the buses. It's the only way to make the white folks see that we will not take this sort of thing any longer." Our greatest concern was how we were going to reach the 50,000 black people of Montgomery, no matter how hard we worked. The white press, in an outraged expose, spread the word for us in a way that would have been impossible with only our own resources. As it happened, a white woman found one of our leaflets, which her Negro maid had left in the kitchen. The irate woman immediately telephoned the newspapers to let the white community know what the blacks were up to. We laughed a lot about this, and Martin later said that we owed them a great debt. On Sunday morning, from their pulpits, almost every Negro minister in town urged people to honor the boycott. Martin came home late Sunday night and began to read the morning paper. The long articles about the proposed boycott accused the NAACP of planning Mrs. Parks on the bus. She had been a volunteer secretary for the Montgomery chapter, and likened the boycott to the tactics of the white citizens' councils. This upset Martin. That awesome conscience of his began to gnaw at him, and he wondered if he were doing the right thing. Alone in his study, he struggled with the question of whether the boycott method was basically unchristian. Certainly it could be used for unethical and to urge men to comply with the law of the land. Our concern was not to put the bus company out of business, but to put justice in business. He recalled Thoreau's words, "We can no longer lend our cooperation to an evil system." And he thought, "He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it." Later, Martin wrote, "From this moment on, I conceived of our movement as an act of massive non-cooperation. From then on, I rarely used the word boycott." A little after midnight, we finally went to bed, but at 5:30 the next morning, we were up and dressed again. The first bus was due at 6 o'clock at the bus stop just outside our house. We had coffee and toast in the kitchen, then went into the living room to watch. Right on time, the bus came, headlights blazing through the December darkness, all lit up inside. I shouted, "Martin, Martin, come quickly." He ran in and stood beside me, his face lit with excitement. There was not one person on that usually crowded bus. We stood together waiting for the next bus. It was empty too, and this was the most heavily traveled line in the whole city. Bus after empty bus paused at the stop and moved on. We were so excited we could hardly speak coherently. Finally, Martin said, "I'm going to take the car and see what's happening other places in the city." He picked up Ralph Abernathy and they cruised together around the city. Martin told me about it when he got home. Everywhere it was the same. A few white people and maybe one or two blacks in otherwise empty buses. Martin and Ralph saw extraordinary sights, the sidewalks crowded with men and women trudging to work, the students of Alabama State College walking or thumbing rides, taxicabs with people clustered in them. Some of our people rode mules. Others went in horse-drawn buggies. But most of them were walking, some making a round trip of as much as 12 miles. Martin later wrote, "As I watched them, I knew that there's nothing more majestic than the determined courage of individuals willing to suffer and sacrifice for their freedom and dignity." The leaders of the movement called a meeting for 3 o'clock in the afternoon to organize the mass meeting to be held that night. Martin was a bit late as he entered the hall. People said to him, "Martin, we've elected you to be our president. Will you accept?" It seems that Rufus A. Lewis, a Montgomery businessman, had proposed Martin, and he had been unanimously elected. The people knew, and Martin knew, that the post was dangerous, for it meant being singled out to become the target of the white people's anger and vengeance. Martin said, "I don't mind. Somebody has to do it. And if you think I can, I will serve." Martin came home at 6 o'clock. He said later that he was nervous about telling me he had accepted the presidency of the protest movement. But he need not have worried, because I sincerely meant what I said when I told him that night, "You know that whatever you do, you have my backing." Reassured, Martin went to his study. He was to make the main speech at the mass meeting that night. It was now 6:30, and this was the way it was usually to be. He had only 20 minutes to prepare what he thought might be the most decisive speech of his life. He said afterward that thinking about the responsibility and the reporters and television cameras, he almost panicked. 5 minutes wasted and only 15 minutes left. At that moment, he turned to prayer. He asked God to restore my balance and to be with me in a time when I need your guidance more than ever. How could he make his speech both militant enough to rouse people to action and yet devoid of hate and resentment? He was determined to do both. Martin and Raff went together to the meeting. When they got within 4 blocks of the Holt Street Baptist Church, there was an enormous traffic jam. 5,000 people stood outside the church listening to loudspeakers and singing hymns. Inside, it was so crowded, Martin told me, the people had to lift Raff and him above the crowd and pass them from hand to hand over their heads to the platform. The crowd and the singing inspired Martin, and God answered his prayer. Later, Martin said, "That night I understood what the older preachers meant when they said, 'Open your mouth and God will speak for you.' First the people sang 'Onward Christian Soldiers' in a tremendous wave of 5,000 voices. This was followed by a prayer and a reading of the scriptures. Martin was introduced. People applauded. Television lights beat upon him. Without any notes at all, he began to speak. Once again, he told the story of Mrs. Parks and rehearsed some of the wrongs black people were suffering. Then he said, 'But there comes a time when people get tired. We're here this evening to say to those who have mistreated us so long that we are tired. Tired of being segregated and humiliated. Tired of being kicked about by the brutal feet of oppression.' The audience cheered wildly, and Martin said, 'We have no alternative but to protest. We have been amazingly patient, but we come here tonight to be saved from the patience that makes us patient with anything less than freedom and justice.'" Having roused the audience for militant action, Martin now set limits upon it. His study of nonviolence and his love of Christ informed his words. He said, "No one must be intimidated to keep them from riding the buses. Our method must be persuasion, not coercion. We will only say to the people, 'Let your conscience be your guide.' Our actions must be guided by the deepest principles of the Christian faith. Once again, we must hear the words of Jesus, 'Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you.' If we fail to do this, our protests will end up as a meaningless drama on the stage of history, and its memory will be shrouded in the ugly garments of shame. We must not become bitter and end up by hating our white brothers. As Booker T. Washington said, let no man pull you so low as to make you hate him. Finally, Martin said, if you will protest courageously and yet with dignity and Christian love, future historians will say, there lived a great people, a black people, who injected new meaning and dignity into the veins of civilization. This is our challenge and our overwhelming responsibility. As Martin finished speaking, the audience rose, cheering in exultation. And in that speech, my husband set the keynote and the tempo of the movement he was to lead, from Montgomery onward. We knew we were in for a long struggle. The white people were expecting the boycott to collapse on the first rainy day. But Martin realized that the way to avoid this was through skillful organization. The first order of business was to get our people to and from work with as little inconvenience as possible. A motor pool of volunteer drivers was organized and pickup stations selected throughout the city with dispatchers to match passengers and destinations. But with all we could do, thousands of people still had to walk. They walked magnificently and proudly. Somebody asked one old grandmother coming down the street if she was not tired. She answered, it used to be my soul was tired and my feet's rested. Now my feet's tired, but my soul is rested. Mass meetings were held twice a week at churches in the city to keep morale up. Thousands of people attended them, some arriving hours ahead of time to be sure of getting a seat. Martin kept a firm hand on the orators to preserve the delicate balance between inspiration and rabble-rousing. By now, he was consciously emulating the Gandhian technique. And many people outside of the South were beginning to realize that something new was taking place in Montgomery. Black people, on their own, were creating a new instrument of social change. They were building and developing a totally new kind of structure. My husband never allowed the struggle to limit itself solely to the needs of black people. He said, what we are doing is not only for the black man, but for the white man too. The system that has banished personality and scarred the soul of the Negro has also damaged the white man's personality, given him a false sense of superiority as it gives the Negro a false sense of inferiority. Segregation is as bad for one as for the other. So in freeing the Negro, we will also free the white man of his misconceptions and his subconscious feeling of guilt toward those he wrongs. One night in January, recalling that I had not wanted to come to Montgomery, I said, oh, Martin, how happy I am to be living in Montgomery with you at this moment in history. But we could not hold that high note all the time. The threats and the real danger sometimes were very depressing. One night at a mass meeting, Martin found himself saying without premeditation, if one day you find me sprawled and dead, I do not want you to retaliate with a single act of violence. I urge you to continue protesting with the same dignity and discipline you have shown so far. On another day, Martin came home feeling very weary. He said later that he had looked at me and the baby and thought they might be taken from me or I from them any time. Then in the middle of the night, the telephone rang. An angry voice said, listen, nigger, we've taken all we want from you. Before next week, you'll be sorry you ever came to Montgomery. It was just another of the abusive calls. But Martin felt he could take no more. He went into the kitchen and made himself a cup of coffee and began to think calmly of the position we were in and what the alternatives were. With his head in his hands, Martin bowed over the table and prayed aloud to God, saying, "Lord, I'm taking a stand for what I believe is right. The people are looking to me for leadership. And if I stand before them without strength and courage, they will falter. I'm at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone." Martin said to me, "At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I have never experienced him before. It seems as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, 'Stand up for righteousness, stand up for truth, and God will be at your side forever.'" Martin said that after this experience, he rose up sure of himself again, ready to face anything. When it became obvious that the boycott was not going to collapse, the city government decided on a get-tough policy. On one of those dreary January afternoons, Martin told me, "You know, someone told me that the police are planning to arrest me on some trumped-up charge." "That would be a good thing," I said. "It would make our people angry and unite them even more. It would be a great mistake, one of the mistakes they will probably make." Martin decided not to try to avoid arrest. He drove downtown to one of the parking lots that was a station for the carpool. Martin picked up three passengers and started out. At the edge of the lot, a policeman stopped him and asked to see his license. As Martin was showing it, he heard another policeman say, "It's that damn King fella." When Martin left the lot, the motorcycle cop followed him. Of course, he drove very carefully, observing all traffic rules. As he stopped to let his passengers out, the policeman pulled alongside and said, "Get out, King. You're under arrest for going 30 in a 25-mile zone." A patrol car pulled up and took Martin to the city jail. He was thrown into a dingy and odorous segregated cell. The first person to reach the jail was Ralph Abernathy. When he offered to post bail for Martin, the official in charge said, "You'll have to wait till tomorrow." "I'm the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Montgomery," Ralph said. "Do you mean to tell me I can't sign a bond?" "No, you can't." "Can I see Dr. King?" "No." Pretty soon, the deacons of the church and many other people began gathering at the jail. It must have looked ominous to the police. Nervously, the jailer hauled Martin out of his cell to a chorus from its inmates. "Don't forget us, Dr. King." Martin was fingerprinted and then was told, "All right, King, you're released on your own recognizance." Martin told me later that he had been a little frightened that first time in jail. He had not even known where the jail was before, and he thought they might be taking him out to lynch him. On Monday, January 30th, 1956, at about 9:30 in the evening, I had put on my robe, and Mary Lucy Williams, our good friend and church member, and I were chatting in the sitting room. I heard a heavy thump on the concrete porch outside. Had I not been anticipating an attack, I might have looked out to see what it was. Instead, I said, "It sounds as if someone has hit the house. We'd better move to the back." We moved fast, not through the hall, which would have taken us nearer to the sound, but straight back through the guest bedroom. We were in the middle of it when there was a thunderous blast. Then smoke and the sound of breaking glass. Mary Lucy grabbed me and started screaming. Her screaming frightened me, and I was shaken by the impact of the noise. I hurried to the bedroom, two rooms back, where Yolanda was in her bassinet. She was all right. and I automatically reached for the telephone. Then I thought, whom am I going to call? I'm not going to call the police in this instance. Then the doorbell started ringing. My first thought was that it was the person who had thrown the bomb. I was trying to think of what I should do about the baby, and for a split second I got panicky. Then I shouted, who is it? And a voice said, is anybody hurt? I went to the door and let in my neighbors. They were frightened and worried. All over our part of town, people had heard the blast and came rushing. The windows had been blown into the living room. The floor was covered with broken glass. The porch had been split, and there was a small hole in the concrete floor. All of the lights were off in the front rooms, and I got a light bulb and screwed it into a socket so we could see. Then I decided to call Ralph Abernathy's First Baptist Church, where the mass meeting was being held and where my husband was speaking. Mrs. Irene Grant, a member of the church whom I knew, answered, and I told her that our house had been bombed. I didn't think about telling her that the baby and I were safe, but I asked her to get some people to the house quickly. My thought was that our friends ought to come for protection. I did not want the police because I could not be sure that they did not know about the bombing before I did. In his account of that terrible night, Martin wrote, strangely enough, I accepted the words of the bombing calmly. My religious experience a few nights before had given me the strength to face it. He interrupted the speech to tell the people what had happened, and he urged them all to go straight home. Don't get panicky and lose your heads, he said. Let us keep moving with the faith that what we are doing is right, and with the even greater faith that God is with us in the struggle. Then Martin rushed home. The situation outside the house was tense and dangerous. Though the crowd was singing, the people were angry and aroused. I remember hearing, my country, 'tis of thee, but you could sense the heat of their anger. Many were armed. Even the little boys had broken bottles. A policeman held back one black man who said, you got your 38, I got mine, let's shoot it out. Later, someone said tension was so high that if a white man had accidentally tripped over a Negro, it could have triggered the most awful riot in our history. The crowd was so wrought up that the white reporters were afraid to leave to file their stories. The faces of Mayor Gale and Commissioner Sellers were deathly pale. They went up to Martin and expressed their regret that this unfortunate incident had taken place in our city. Chairman C.T. Smiley of Dexter's trustee board and principal of Booker T. Washington High School, the largest Negro high school in the city, standing beside Martin, said angrily, regrets are all very well, but you are responsible. It is you who created the climate for this. More people were joining the crowd every minute. They stood swaying and muttering and shouting insults at the nervous police. At that point, Martin walked out on the porch. In some ways, it was the most important hour of his life. His own home had just been bombed. His wife and baby could have been killed. This was the first deep test of his Christian principles and his theories of nonviolence. Standing there, very grave and calm, he dominated those furious people. He held up his hand, and they were suddenly silent. The crowd of angry men and women, of excited children and sullen, frightened policemen in a clump by the steps, all were absolutely still. In a calm voice, Martin said, my wife and my baby are all right. I want you to go home and put down your weapons. We cannot solve this problem through retaliatory violence. We must meet violence with nonviolence. Remember the words of Jesus. He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword. After that, the crowd began to thin out, and the people went back to their homes. A white policeman's voice was heard in the crowd saying, "If it hadn't been for that nigger preacher, we'd all be dead."